The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to CBF Legal. Well done. You've almost come on the shortest day of the year, the winter solstice. I think that's tomorrow or possibly the day after. In any event, well done for making it through rather cold weather this morning. Well, we look forward to hearing from Ian Powell as Ian continues our three-part series in this rather fancy title, Sue Generous and Eucatastrophes. Not quite sure if I've pronounced that correctly, but no doubt we'll be enlightened very shortly. What will make your heart sing is this morning's talk. Now, the usual drill, Ian will speak for about 20 minutes, and your chance to make any comments or questions, scribble them out on the little bits of paper on your table. I'll collect those, and Ian will do his best to respond, and we'll be done by 20 past the hour. I'm just going to read inside your program, if you wish to open that up, on the left-hand side. I'm just going to read the last paragraph there, starting with "but." But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate.
Good morning. I'd like to do something I don't know if I've done it in some years. I'd like to begin by reading some poetry. It's also a poem that is sung. Some of you may... It's the first and the last verse of a poem or a song. And it goes like this. My song is love unknown, my Saviour's love to me. Love to the loveless shown, that they might lovely be. Oh, who am I that for my sake, my Lord should take frail flesh and die? Here might I stay and sing no story so divine. Never was love, dear King, never was grief like thine. This is my friend, in whose sweet praise I all my days could gladly spend. A few years ago, when I was reading one of a number of books speaking about the wickedness of religion in the world, I went to a Good Friday service, and I came out thinking I've just spent an hour and a half or so singing and hearing about love, sacrifice, the whole business of the care of the other, the intense love that God allegedly has for tiny humans. And I thought, very difficult to see how this could do anything other than be good for people. And I thought of my friends and family. I thought, what a shame they never get to spend an hour and a half engulfed and, as it were, swimming in such magnificent possible realities of love like that. Now, I've got two pretentious words there for you. It's not because lawyers are pretentious, but because I figure most of you guys and gals are good with words. The first one is a Latin term, which means in a class of its own. With no other groups, it's a one-off. It's an utterly unique thing. Its explanation is only within itself as part of what it can also mean. And we looked at that with Jesus, whether or not Jesus is a sui generis, that is, that there's simply no one, when he's half rightly understood, who is in the same category as him. He's a vert, not an a. But today I'd like to bring you another word, which I only really learned about a month ago. And I learned about it listening to a man called Keller, who works in New York. And he was referring to J.R. Tolkien. And Tolkien makes this word up. And it's in his essay on fairy tales, which is about 70 pages long. And he talks about Tolkien, who knows a bit about stories, and worked on the similar sort of story with C.S. Lewis, whose whole area was ancient medieval mythology. This eucatastrophe is a word. He says there's all different sorts of stories that people enjoy hearing. But he said that the stories that people most like, and the stories most likely to move you to tears, are what he calls eucatastrophes. And the little EU at the beginning of something means good. So it's the idea that there is a catastrophe, something terrible happening. It seems hopeless, and the hero seems helpless. And suddenly, right at the end, someone steps in who reverses everything. So what should have been a tragedy becomes actually a comedy. And normally, the key person is the most unlikely person. It's not the US cavalry riding over the hill and rescuing by sheer obvious invincible power. But it's someone weak, it's someone small, it's in the moment of apparent defeat. And Tolkien reckons this story is the story that most deeply resonates with humans. He suggests that there are a number of stories like it. I mean, one obvious one might be Beauty and the Beast, where there is this horrible, ugly, scary, cranky beast, and this beautiful woman, and she loves the beast, thus transforming the beast, and also discovering that he's actually beautiful and powerful and wealthy. So her life was also transformed. The Ugly Duckling's got a bit of that story. It's the unlikely and of course, Lord of the Rings is full of that, isn't it? Where it's the weak, unwarlike hobbits who control destiny, and arguably, at the very end, when they're fighting over that river of lava and fire and the ring itself is about to be destroyed, it's because of the weakness of the two, of both the nice hobbit and the ex-hobbit. It's because they're both enslaved by the ring that they fight, and eventually the ring is lost. So it's through weakness, it's through folly, it's through the un-hero-like that the great work is done. And Tolkien suggests this story is the most exciting of stories, not his story. And he says, he argues that there are a number of stories like that that human beings love to hear, and love to hear them retold and retold and retold. And he says, it's because in the human heart, he said, there are certain strings, like that of a cello or something, and these stories make those strings resonate. But he says, there's only one story that really plucks the strings deliberately. And he says, that is the great eucatastrophe, which is found in, of course, Jesus. This story of the one who, at the point of defeat, and in the point of his weakness, does his great work of triumph, where we who are hopelessly and rightly lost are saved by this very unlikely character. Now, Jesus himself is known as a storyteller. We looked at that a little while ago. No one tells parables like Jesus. There is no one in history whose teaching is as dominated by parables as Jesus. Ironically, for those who want to suggest that Jesus is just a construction of the early church, there is no one in the early church who tells parables. So we look at the writings of Peter, John, James, these guys. They're not parable makers. We looked at the way in which when Paul has a go at telling a few parables, he really botches it up. But suddenly, when they tell the story of Jesus, and then they write the story of Jesus, it's full of parables. It really is a desperate ploy to suggest these other people made it up and imposed it on Jesus, like the silliness suggesting that there's no Shakespeare. There's always a movie to be made in that nonsense. But when you get this plethora of amazing creations, by far the most obvious way is to think that someone lies behind it. But it's not the stories of Jesus that the early Christians preached. So, as people have rightly said, it's not the Sermon on the Mount that changed the world. It's the story of the cross on the hill. That's a bit corny, isn't it? Sermon on the Mount, cross on the hill. But when you hear what the early Christians preached, you can read some of it in the book of Acts, you can read some of it just in the early histories, they didn't preach about Jesus' stories. They didn't go around telling the story of the Good Samaritan, telling the story of the prodigal son. They told the story of Jesus' life and deeds, the story about him. But when you actually run into him, you find he is himself a storyteller. And we're going to look at that because many of these stories contain the shadow of what is coming. So in the end, the story that is complete by the end of Jesus' life is foreshadowed in many of his stories, with a touch of the eucatastrophe in them, but quite unique. The quote you've got there is from John 7, right at the beginning, where a number of soldiers are sent off to arrest Jesus because he's causing such trouble, just by what he's saying, not by what he's doing particularly at that point, and they come back without him. And the religious authorities, the Pharisees, say to him, well, where is he? And they came back with this strange statement: no man ever spoke like this man. That they'd gone to arrest him and were so entranced by what he said, and you can read what they saw in John chapter 7. But there is something about the way Jesus speaks that whether we follow him or not, whether or not we think there's a God or not, is quite unique. And only the blind and the pig-headed would pretend that isn't the case. So I'm going to draw your attention to two of the stories, two of the best-known stories, and see how the way in which they pick up this great theme that his own life is in the end, and their touches of the ewe catastrophe. Now, how about if I stop there? Are we reasonably clear on those two pretentious words I'm using? Okay, just in, all right, good, I'll move on then. Now, I think the best known of Jesus' parables is the Good Samaritan. We could argue that, but I think that's probably the case, the Good Samaritan. And people use the word Good Samaritan often. I looked up a website that would tell you 10 of the best Good Samaritan stories from recent history. And they're very, very lovely stories of people intervening to help someone who's in trouble. But only one of them is really a Good Samaritan story, a story of a Muslim kid on a train in New York who rescued a Jewish girl. She had apparently responded to someone saying Happy Christmas by offering a Happy Hanukkah or something like that, and these guys were roughing her up, and a Muslim kid stepped in to help her and save her. Perhaps the easiest way to understand the significance of the Good Samaritan is to realise what didn't need explaining for Jesus and his contemporaries, which is the relationship between the Jews and Samaritans. If you're an ordinary, white, sort of Anglo-Celtic, sort of Australian, it's hard for us to realise the level of hatred there is between some ethnic groups that have bumped against each other for a long, 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 long time. We read our, you know, oh, I should say, I sometimes read the level of hatred that goes round and round. I think, what is wrong with those people? Of course, I've got no idea what it's like. But the Samaritans and the Jews have been going on for some time. So if I was a semi-religious Jew, and this was my favourite cup that I'd inherited from my grandmother, Royal China, and the shadow of a Samaritan came over it, just the shadow of a Samaritan, I would never use it again. It is utterly, it is so filthy, it is made so corrupted just by the shadow of a Samaritan. I mean, can you imagine what that level of... One of the great rabbis from the first century said that to eat with a Samaritan was the same as eating with a pig. And again, I like piggies. I mean, I don't want to live with them, but I love eating them. But the visceral... So that's the significance of the Good Samaritan. It's not just someone who meets someone in trouble and helps. So we've got these Good Samaritan laws in many countries, and they're great laws. It's a shame they have to be made into laws. For example, I'll give you one from Argentina. It's actually called the Law of the Abandonment of Persons. It says this, so I'll translate it from the Argentinian for you. A person who endangers the life or health of another, either by putting a person in jeopardy or abandoning to their fate a person unable to cope alone, who must be cared for, will be imprisoned for between 2 and 6 years. Right? So if you see someone and you abandon them to their fate and you don't help and you could, that's one of what is many of the laws called the Good Samaritan laws. Some of them are made to protect people who help so they don't get sued, but some of them are simply saying if you see someone in need and don't help, you will be punished. So there's the first story there in Luke 10. We're not going to read, there's a massive text there. But you may know the story. The guy is going for a walk from Jerusalem to Jericho. He's not going for a walk. Nobody walked that road. It was called the Road of Blood. And even in the Old Testament, when it's mentioned in the book of Joshua, that road has got the sense of blood about it. If you walk it, it's a great place to be robbed. In fact, I met some people who were robbed on that road, even in the last few years. It winds its way between many rocks and caves, and it's lonely. There are many lonely places. This man is going for presumably business of some kind. He gets attacked by robbers. They strip him of his clothes, beat him. They stole everything, including his clothes. So if your house has been robbed and you've lost everything, nothing compared to this bloke. He's lost everything, including his clothes. He's lying on the road, half dead, bleeding. Oh, thank goodness. A priest comes by. Now, this was not a culture that hated religion like ours. So they think, good, a priest, he's okay. But the priest walks on the other side of the road. There are all sorts of theories about why he does it. Jesus couldn't care less why he does it. It's not why he did it. It's that he didn't care. He didn't love. Then a Levite comes, another sort of priest, does the same thing. But a Samaritan, as he travelled, came where the man was. Now, if you're a Jew, you're probably thinking, oh, great. Now this guy's going to be skinned. It's the only thing he's got left. Right? I remember watching some boys at shore, very creative. They'd done a bit of work. They had to do a play on the Good Samaritan. And so one of the boys, year eight, they got up to do a play of it. And when the Samaritan came, the boy began to pretend to unbuckle his pants and do his business on the, you know, well, it's a bit crass, but at least he got the idea. So when the Jews hear, a priest goes past nothing, a Levite goes past nothing, now a Samaritan, now the boy's in big trouble. And so Jesus gets this enemy, meets presumably a Jew, because almost everyone who traveled that road was Jewish, and he feels compassion for him. It's the word, his guts were moved, his guts were squeezed. And then he does six things to him, goes over to him, bandages him, puts oil and wine, used for medicine, puts him on his donkey, takes him to an inn, stays the night with him, caring for him, then gives the innkeeper enough money for 24 nights, it's a standard sort of, it's a long time, and says, I'll come back, if we're any more, I'll look after it. It is an extraordinary act of love, but the significance in Jesus is, it's a Samaritan who does it. Jesus is never just saying, be nice. It's always about love across it. It's loving the wrong person. It's where you love your enemy. It's when you're kind to the person who deserves your cruelty. That's what Jesus is on about. It's sort of eucatastrophic in as much as at the point when the man's last hope has gone, the Levite, and the Samaritan comes, you expect it to go very badly. That's when it suddenly becomes a good news story and the man is cared for and loved. I mean, the Samaritan also, he wasn't out doing nothing. He was in enemy territory. When you see a man who's beaten up and has been robbed on the road, what do you know about the area? You know it's not an area to stop. He's got places to go, people to see, business to make, deals to do. But he stops at least for a whole extra night in the inn. Love is always an inconvenience. And it is especially shown when you love the enemy. Now, some of you will know what the early church did. I used to think this was such a farce, what the early church did with this. But now I'm more impressed with it than I was, although I still think it's wrong. When I used to go to church at North Sydney, I actually heard a man preach exactly like this. He was a returned missionary, and he used this story. And as he began, I think, oh, wow, I've never heard the Good Samaritan allegorized like this. And you know how it works? The man going down from Jerusalem, good city, Jericho, that's humans. Get beaten up by robbers, what's that? That's the devil. He's left dying on the road. He's alive, but only just, soon to die. Religion in various forms come past, does nothing. The Good Samaritan comes past, that's Jesus, not sure why. He gets off, he cares, he bandages him, puts him on the donkey, that's symbolic of his human nature. Takes him to the inn, the church, gives two coins, baptism and the Lord's Supper. It's terrifically clever, and says, I'll come back. Could it be any clearer? It's about Jesus and us. It's about salvation. It's the eucatastrophe done in the story. Now, I think that's just a wonderful, happy coincidence, particularly the two coins. That's lovely. But I think they've actually got something that they've seen. That behind how Jesus says we should live is the heart and nature of God. It's the story that hasn't even been told at this point. He hasn't done the great salvation. He hasn't died for us at this point. But actually, I think the early church saw something right, although it's really about how you treat the next jerk you meet. Or, for me, it's often, I realised that the person who was my enemy, I had in a separate category. I didn't even realise they were my enemy. I didn't have to love them because they almost weren't human in my head. They were just a laughing stock and a joke. And then I was, no, that's the person Jesus is calling me to love. So that's what he's doing there. It's all about the compassion. Let's run quickly into the second story. This is the one which Charles Dickens describes, and Dickens knows a little bit about writing. He describes it as the greatest short story ever told. And as I say, one of the marks of the blindness of some enemies of Christianity is that they don't stand in wonder at some of this stuff. Perhaps because they've heard it too often, they've lost it. But Dickens rightly says, this is the greatest short story ever told. It's the story of the man with the father with two sons. Although there's a third son, but there's only two that are prominent. The one son runs off selfishly, wishes his father dead, doesn't want the relationship with the dad, just wants his father's stuff, gets as far away from home as possible, wastes it all, finishes up, remember these are Jewish people, this is a good Jewish boy, working for a Gentile, working amongst the pigs, envying the pigs. It is like you having a son who runs away from home and ends up selling his body as a male prostitute. It's a nightmare scenario. He's got nothing left. He cannot go home. We've actually got an ancient letter, not from a Jew to his dad, but from a Greek to his Greek mother, begging for permission to come home. He said, "I'm starving, I'm naked, I'm aware of the foolishness of what I've done. Please let me come home." We never got the mother's letter back. But the boy hopes that perhaps his father will employ him. He knows he cannot be son again. That's just an absurdity. He's lucky the father saw him and not the older brother. Because if the older brother would have sent him, he'd got the shotgun out and put it to good use. But, you know, in the story, the father sees him like the Good Samaritan. He is filled with compassion. His guts are squeezed. And forgetting everything this little jerk has done, and everything he's done to brought shame and damage to the family, which he has, to humiliate the father, to sell off family land, etc., he runs to him, and he does all these things which are, you would do, I think, if you had someone who had risked their life for the family. If you had someone, as it were, who'd gone off to battle and saved the family, you would treat them like this. But you would never run. The father says, see what it says there in verse 20? He was filled with compassion. He ran to his son. Some of you will know this already, that Middle Eastern patriarchs never run. Children can run. Slaves can be made to run. The patriarch never, ever runs. He walks. You see that with the oil sheiks. Boy, those guys know how to move. They walk like they own the earth, and they own lots of it. But he runs, which is an absurdity. It's because he's so overwhelmed with excitement because this filthy, selfish jerk is coming home. He runs, grabs him, kisses him, and the word is he kissed him and he kissed him and he kissed him. He barely listens to the boy's little confessional speech, and the party is on. It's all wrong. It's borderline immoral, that sort of love, that holds the boy in no way responsible. Doesn't even allow him to make the confession. The father is completely forgetful of all that this son has done and all that he deserves. It's that sort of... It's catastrophic because the son is dead. He's a dead man walking. He has no hope at all. His only hope is to go to the very person who he's hurt and offended. And yet, at the point when he hopes to get a job as the lowest of the lowest slaves, he's totally, instantly, immediately re-embraced. That's what God is like, according to Jesus. That's the second most perfect picture of God you're ever going to see, is in this parable, in this story of Jesus. And it's got that sort of rescue at the end, the unexpected end. The third son is, of course, the son who's telling the story. That's why we take the story seriously. If just somebody gets up and says, "God is ever so terribly kind and loving," you've got every right to say, "Yes, so you say." But it's the fact that it's the Son of God himself who's come and told this story about his father that is so impressive. Well, I need to rush on, so we've got some time for questions, to the last point. And you catastrophes and the DNA of the universe. In 2010, I went and saw the Sydney Theatre Company put on a Greek tragedy. I think it was called Oresteia. A friend couldn't go, and I had some cultured friends that I had a spare ticket. That's how I got there. It's not the sort of thing I would ever book up for myself. And frankly, I don't think I'm ever going to a Greek tragedy again. I think even if you gave me a ticket, I don't know if I'd ever go. It was terrific drama, but it was so depressing. You know, this happened, therefore that had to happen, therefore they had to do that, but that of course cursed them, and they had to do that, but that of course cursed them. And it was a flipping nightmare in the end. Once the first wrong had been done, the whole thing falls apart, and there is no eucatastrophe. It's just pure catastrophe. If you've seen The Grudge, a Japanese horror film, again, there is no eucatastrophe. It's just horror upon horror. There is no answer to evil. The movie finishes with the house with this deadly evil inside it, just waiting for the next innocent goose who buys it. You know, brought to you by a friendly, smiling real estate agent. But at the heart of Christianity, and therefore infusing a lot of Western culture, is this kind of optimism that says even when everything is hopeless, very often at that very moment, God may well break in and intervene. The Bible is full of it in a way that other religious texts simply aren't. So Abram is an old man who's just going to end up dust to dust with no children. And at the point he's hopeless, he's promised children. He has to wait until he's 99 before it comes to be. Israel with the Exodus. We're watching a genocide unfold. The women are being taken, the young babies, boys have been killed, and all the adults are in slavery. We're watching one more genocide of a power by a powerful government. When Israel is devoured by Babylon and sent off into captivity like dozens of other countries, the only culture that survives are the Jews. Because at the point when there's no hope, God brings some home. And of course, Jesus himself, a good man, a weak man, who dies and is overwhelmed by Imperial Rome and the power of the religious establishment, utterly deserted by his friends. It's an awful story. And right at the end, we discover that at the moment of weakness and defeat, God is doing his most powerful, beautiful and victorious work. And Christianity is born where? In a cemetery. Born in a cemetery. Right? That's where it starts. The good news starts. The euangelion's got that same thing. Angelos is the word, the idea of message. The eu part, the joyful, the good. Eucatastrophe, euangelion, it's all happening. Starts in a cemetery. This is what Christianity is all about. It's that idea of the great reversal. Now, the reason there's a great reversal is because of the DNA of the universe. Now, I'm probably going to get the science wrong. I understand that when my mum and dad made love and you know, the right seed got together, they all got together. What was constructed there was my DNA. And what you see before you is not entirely due to the DNA, but substantially due to the DNA. Other things have come in. Now, what is the thing at the core and heart and soul of the universe? One of the things that is so beautiful, I think, for me as a Christian, you know, having been a Christian after Yonks, and you know, I became a Christian, I've shared with you in the past, reluctantly because I got convinced it was true. One of the things that has increasingly excited me, I don't quite know how to explain it yet, is the pure coherence within Christianity, from its first principles at the very source of everything of the universe, all the way through. This is not a cheap shot, at least I don't think it is, but when Richard Dawkins was here a little while ago, he was involved in a terrible debate. Atheists were embarrassed, Christians were embarrassed on Q&A. Both teams had dodgy champions, I think. It was an ugly night. But Richard Dawkins was quite clear. He doesn't want people to live by Darwin's theories because it's a brutal life if you do. So here's his thing. The fundamental explanation of the universe is the Darwinian theory, neo-Darwinian evolution. But please don't live by it because that won't work. So there's a fundamental incoherence about the worldview. Atheism taken seriously, well, as Richard Dawkins says, at the bottom, that is at the source, at the foundation, there is no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Energy. That's all there is. Laws come from somewhere. And so that's the nature of the universe. And human personality and love and dreams are just scum on the pond of life. It's come, it'll go. Carl Sagan says, the universe seems neither benign nor hostile, just indifferent. That may be the case. What Jesus brings is the news and the knowledge that at the heart and source and root of everything is love. God is love. God is relationship. And that this brings the whole story together. And what you get in the great story at the heart of Christianity is the revelation of what has always been at the heart and soul of everything. There's a pure coherence between how I should treat everyone I meet today and what has eternally been there before the beginning of everything. And what is there is this extraordinary love that is celebrated. And it's revealed, above all, at that moment of pathetic, tragic defeat. So the poet says, my song is love unknown, my Saviour's love to me, love to the loveless shown, that they might lovely be. No story so divine. Never was love, dear King. Never was grief like thine. This is my friend, in whose sweet praise I all my days could gladly spend. What is true of Jesus and the great story is picked up and shadowed in the other stories that he tells. This is what you'd expect. There's a coherence between his story and the stories he tells, both about how you should treat your neighbour and how God treats us. Well, I should be silent there, so there's some time for questions.
Coming in thick and fast. So if you do have a question still, drop down on this paper and I'll hurry along and collect them.
All right. Shall I start since there's so many?
You should.
Are not Shakespeare's major tragedies not essential for education? Yes, I think tragedies are. I mean, that seems to be what Greek theatre is about. It's saying to the Greek culture, don't misbehave. If you misbehave, the ramifications of your momentary act of selfishness can be catastrophic for a whole society. And so they really are, they're doing what people think Christianity is doing, which is trying to control society. Which is always a foolishness, because Christianity grew and did its great thinking when it was so far from controlling anything. It just doesn't make sense. You could do that with Confucianism, I think. You could do it with Greek plays. And we learn really good things through King Lear, through Macbeth. So tragedies have got an important part to play. But if that's all you've got going, it does rightly lead to a depressing life. Is the ability to forgive an essential element of being Christian? Absolutely. A person who says, I'm Christian, but says, I will never forgive that person, really has work to do. I know exactly what it means to say, I don't know how I'm ever going to forgive that person. But as a Christian, I can never give myself permission to say, I don't care what happens, I will never forgive that person. Because, you know, in the middle of the Lord's Prayer, we seek, forgive us as we forgive those. And the only line in the Lord's Prayer Jesus comes back and comments on is that thing. If you will not forgive, do not expect your Father to forgive. We're brought in the story of Jesus into a world of forgiveness. So yes, Christians are to be people of forgiveness. I remember I shared this some years ago with you, seeing a Holocaust survivor from Holland whose entire family had been wiped out by the Nazis. And the interviewer, that sort of trite leftover remnant of Christianity in his head, said, you know, asked about forgiveness. And I remember watching the man, he steeled up and he said, I am not a Christian. I do not have to forgive. And I thought he was absolutely right. You know, I'm not saying what his worldview says, but he's right about the fact that as a Christian, we have no choice. And psychologists have shown this is entirely secondary. That, and you can learn this from Oprah too, that if you want to really hurt yourself, hang on to your anger. It just, in the end, it destroys you. Do current laws impede Good Samaritans in their coming to the aid of strangers? That I don't know. It'll vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But some of the laws, and I think the ones particularly in America, were to protect people from being sued. There was a little kid in China who was run over, a little two-year-old. And there's in the video of it, there's a whole lot of people watching. And it was hit by two different cars. And those who examined it thought what seemed to have held the people back from helping was the people had got in trouble for helping, and there was this. And so the Good Samaritan laws are significantly, there's two sorts. One is to say, if you don't help, you're in trouble, and secondly to say, if you do help, you're safe. So they seem to be of two different sorts. Luke 10, was compassion for the stranger in trouble unknown to the first century Jews, or was the point that a Samaritan showed mercy? I think human beings are hard, as I understand what the Bible says, humans is we're made by God. And the law of God is built within us, all of us, common grace. So therefore we will feel compassion for people when we see suffering. The charities know this, so they put terrible pictures up of kids dying, and we just actually want to do something. But it's the compassion for the enemy. It's, you know, as people have said, and I don't, you know, it's just... It's the story of the Taliban guy laying down his life to rescue, you know, a US Navy SEAL or something like that. It just doesn't happen. It's love across those boundaries of hatred. That's the thing that Jesus brings that is distinctive. There is, as people say, the silver law, which is don't do to others what you don't want done to you, which is common enough around the world. The golden rule, as it sometimes says, do to others what you would like them, is not at all common. Not at all common. But that's at least what Christianity says. But Jesus goes even further and says, love your enemy. And that's why he chooses the Good Samaritan. That's the one who knows what it is to love as God has said. Was the forgiveness of the father of the prodigal son completely unknown to the first century? Would a father shun the son out of shame as a cultural norm. The absolute expectation is that the son, in real life, the son would probably not even have thought of going home, and the father would certainly not have welcomed him like this. I have no doubt, personally, that the Good Samaritan and the prodigal son are not true stories, by which I mean, the trouble with true and stories is they're both ambiguous phrases. That is, I don't think there was any, you know, that you could have ever filmed the Good Samaritan happening. It's a story where Jesus is trying to teach us a ridiculous sort of love that is way back in the heart of the universe, before the universe, and is embodied and revealed in his life and death for us. And he's trying to teach it. The prodigal son, the more I've read it, and tried, it's a nonsense story. But then many of Jesus' stories are, he's trying to reveal to us, you know, the God who is not like us. And I hope that was an answer to that question. How is loving your neighbour different to the Buddhist philosophy of karma? Not an expert. But Buddhist... I think this is true. Buddhism has no history of creating hospitals for needy people. It has no history of educating anything other than monks. The basic thing is more like they say with neurosurgeons, do no harm. Right? There's talk about compassion, but the idea of intervening to help, to make a difference, that is not, you know, a given in Buddhist philosophy, and certainly in Hinduism, where I've heard this more clearly, and Buddhism is a sort of a reformed Hinduism, historically. There are real discussions that Hindus have about, do I intervene to help a child born with a deformity? Because if they're born with that deformity, it's their karma. The beautiful thing about karma and reincarnation is it answers all the hard questions. So when the tsunami came through and wiped out quite a few people in Sri Lanka, I heard a Buddhist monk say exactly what the English soccer coach said, but he got sacked for it. But a Buddhist monk said, he was asked, why did this happen? It was their karma. That the people who drowned in the face of the tsunami, it's because that's what they deserved. Now, that is not a view Christianity shares. That's why Buddhism will not create sort of great, it won't create world vision, etc. Buddhist countries are echoing that, but it hasn't grown out of the fruit of the tree. Buddhism is a beautiful, noble philosophy, but it's not strong on the question of that sort of sacrificial interventionist love, which is such a mark of the new catastrophe that is brought to us by Jesus. Well, I hope that wasn't too insulting.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.